Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for stopping by. Either if you are listening through our websites, redicecreations.com, redicecreations.net, or redicemembers.com. You can stream or download from there. We also have a podcast feed and RSS feed that you can subscribe to. And with a podcast app or a feed reader such as iTunes, you can get the latest programs right to you. You can also hear us on Stitcher, YouTube, and a number of other places that picks up our feed. If you are a new listener, you might want to know that this is a program and website dedicated to trying to understand why things are the way they are. We are primarily driven by getting to the truth regarding a number of different topics that we find to be among some of the most important and interesting. We do not always agree with all our guests, and you might find some highly controversial and politically incorrect, something that we encourage in these times, as we are on a very dangerous slope that goes against European tradition of free speech, freedom of opinion, and freedom of thought. We are also very interested in giving space and room to those who are pushed towards the fringes of media and academia, those who are censored and whose voices are not heard in the mainstream media. Unfortunately, we are now in a time when perspectives, research, discussion, and debate regarding many topics, I'd say those that are affecting us the most, have been completely censored, denied, and deemed morally reprehensible. We could argue that this is because they go against the opinions and direction of the political elite, and much of the censored work of these academics shows errors in the history, flaws, and double standards in their proposals, and major holes in the current wisdom of our times. So we have reached a stage here where those people are completely denied the same level of attention and time. That's one of the many reasons we find it to be important to do what those public service channels, at least in Europe, are not doing by listening to all sides of the story. And regarding many of the topics that we do address, you have most of the opposition to these well represented in the mainstream media. So we are not interested in perpetuating those same lies and the same cover-up. Here, instead, you will hear the uncensored version of many of the things that you never knew about and all the things that we are not allowed or supposed to discuss. Our guest today is Professor Kevin MacDonald. He received his PhD in biobehavioral sciences and is a professor of psychology at California State University, Long Beach. MacDonald is the author of 7 books on evolutionary psychology and child development, and he is the author and editor of over 30 academic articles. His magnum opus is The Culture of Critique, a highly recommended academic work. His research focuses on evolutionary psychology and on ethnicity and ethnic group conflict. He is the founder of the Occidental Observer, an online publication presenting original content touching on the themes of white identity, white interests, and the culture of the West. He has been with us 2 times before, and today our topic is going to be pathological altruism, particularly among Northern Europeans, as we'll discuss what is the evolutionary and historical foundation of this. We are also going to confront the moral indictments that are made against white Europeans today and discuss why it is not only a moral battle, but at the heart of the matter regarding our survival, it is a moral question. And that's one of the reasons why the concern for our survival is a legitimate one. Welcome back, Mr. MacDonald. Always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us again, Kevin.
It's great to be here, Henry.
Thank you. Now, you did a couple of lectures, one in London and one in Stockholm recently, with focus on the genetic basis for, altruism, I guess, and the lack of ethnic awareness or kinship-oriented nepotism. And you raised things such as the Scandinavians knows about this, the Jantelag. There's other examples that suggest that there is reason, perhaps it's genetic or evolutionary, that Sweden and other Scandinavian countries, Northern European people, have the type of attitude they have. And that's one of the reasons why we've gotten some of the most extreme immigration policy, definitely in Sweden for sure. But it is kind of a pathological altruism. And I wanted to begin on this note, Kevin, and maybe you can tell us about the kind of research you've done and dug into lately, and let our listeners know about how you view the moral question of having ethnic interests, in particular when we are speaking about Northern European people, and how you think the situation that we are in right now has arisen.
Yeah, it's sort of a long story, and I should preface it by saying that this is a very difficult area, and There's certainly room for a lot of different ideas here, but what I've been honing in on is the idea that that there's something sort of special about Northern Europe that at least in the last several hundred years, what we have seen emerging is a sort of hunter-gatherer mentality, which is. There are some recent genetic studies showing that the hunter-gatherer genes are more common in Northern Europe, and especially in Sweden and Scandinavia. And that looking at what hunter-gatherer groups are typically like, and especially trying to understand the evolution of individualism, as individualists tend to be relatively non-kin-oriented. They're not as ethnocentric. They don't form groups based on kinship so much, clan type societies. The groups are very egalitarian. You were mentioning the Yante laws. Well, that is extremely egalitarianism. And if you look at hunter gatherer groups around the world, they tend to be very egalitarian. That is, if one person sort of tries to rise above the others, the others will quickly push them back down. So these are very egalitarian groups, and especially in the north of Europe, they do not seem to have evolved close family ties or close kinship ties. And so fundamentally, the idea is that these Northern European groups are a response to the conditions of the ice ages. And this was first proposed, I think, around 1930 with Fritz Lenz, who's a population geneticist, very famous geneticist, talking about the adverse climate of the ice ages, and that so these Northern European groups were fundamentally evolved to confront these very adverse circumstances, where to other parts of the world there's much more between group competition and much larger role for clans and kinship. In Northern Europe, it was not based so much on that. And so you have groups that are not based on kinship, but are more based on reputation. And particularly important is your moral reputation. Are you an honest person? You can sort of imagine a group. This is the way I imagine it in the Ice Ages. And you see somebody that would like to be possibly in your group. Well, what are you going to ask yourself? What they were not asking themselves, apparently, is how closely related are you? What they were asking is, are you a good person? Are you competent?
Right.
Can you help us deal with these adverse situations that we have to deal with every day? This is a very difficult climate, the scarcity of resources and so on. But are you an honest person? Can we trust you? Those are the kinds of things that had to be there to cement those groups. It was not based so much on kinship. Now, if you go to the Middle East or China or Africa, kinship looms very, very large. Those societies are fundamentally based on kinship, and your entire place in society really has to do with where you are in the kinship group. That does not seem to have been the case in Northern Europe.
So it has a basis probably in survival, and that the hunter-gatherers were forced to adopt a different strategy than others, and I guess also those who are prone to cooperate in a different way, they simply survived while those who were going their own way didn't. And hence we have this kind of genetic predisposition of sorts. Is that correct?
Yes. And I think a good way to think about that is marriage, because the idea is that these hunter-gatherer groups were essentially monogamous. And you had to be monogamous because say you fathered a child, you had an affair, and you left this woman with her child, that child is not going to survive. So there is strong selection for pair bonding and for the investment by fathers in their children. Fathers who did not invest in their children did not have grandchildren. And women who were stuck without a father, probably their children would not survive. So a very strong emphasis on affection and love as a basis of marriage. Again, a very strong emphasis on father involvement in child rearing.
So that's a little bit different, because I remember reading what was his name, the Kostelich man, or the Kostanik, I guess, that they were released an article a while back here. They talked about the Scandinavians were the earliest Europeans, and that there might be a tie-in here, obviously, with both Neanderthals, but that there is a difference, I guess, between Northern Europeans as opposed to many other people. And I was curious about if this lies at the foundation of why we are today in the situation we are, because I think, Kevin, when you speak about this, that maybe this would create suspicion, maybe if they were prone not to let in certain individuals into that group before they could vet them, as you said. Do you think that's a possibility?
That you're asking if there would be more suspicion of people who are strangers or something?
Exactly, outsiders, so to speak, that they would be more prone to keep them out because that might have posed a danger to the larger group.
Well, it certainly would. That's why these people had to be vetted. They would probably via word of mouth. You probably wouldn't just take someone that you didn't know at all, but you would trust other people's judgment. Sort of like applying for a job where you get recommendations and so on. I don't think just pure strangers would be allowed in the group unless there was sort of the person was obviously a good warrior, a very good physical specimen or something like that. But what I'm trying to get at though is that the point was to get people who would fit in well to the group, but also be an asset to the group. Would be essentially honest, trustworthy kind of person. Would be the kind of person you'd want in those groups. And again, in the overheads that I had for my lectures in Sweden, I had a recent genetic study showing that as you go north in Europe, these hunter-gatherer genes, and they can actually pinpoint those now, these hunter-gatherer genes are more and more common. Whereas when you go in southern Europe, there's much more what we call these Middle Eastern farmer genes. So the first people in Europe, as you were saying, were the hunter-gatherer groups. And then around 5,000 BC or so, you had these farmers from the Middle East come in. And then much later, you had the Indo-Europeans coming in. So those are the three groups, really, I think, that population genetic research is showing. But the first groups were hunter-gatherer groups, and my theory that I'm working on now is that had more of an influence on Northern European society and Scandinavian in particular.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more about how you think that this is playing out today then and the application of what we see, because if we run through history, I sent you an email about this before as well, it seems to me that maybe, and I'm uncertain about this, I haven't read enough to figure this out, but it seems that it was a little bit more kinship-oriented previously in Scandinavian history. For example, during the Viking Age, there are, however, I should mention, finds, for example, where you have, women who have been buried in some of the ships, like the Oseberg ship in Norway and whatnot. They had Middle Eastern origin and things like this, and they were probably very, very close to the family. Sure, granted, these might have actually been sacrificed to, you know, the king who was buried in some of these barrows and mounds and whatnot. But my feeling a little bit, Kevin, is that parts of this mentality has been inserted upon us afterwards. I don't know if it's propaganda or something else, but what do you believe here? Do you think if you look at the Viking Age, for example, has it always been on that same level as we're talking about now?
No, it definitely is not, and that's an important thing. If you look at my lecture, right at the end of the lecture, I talk about two very powerful currents in European history. The second one comes from the Indo-Europeans. Indo-Europeans came in around 3500 BC and essentially conquered all of Europe. These are sort of military groups centered around leaders that were able to essentially conquer these various areas. This was a very successful group. This group started in essentially north of the Caspian Sea, what they call the Pontic Steppes, expanded westward into Europe, but then it also went southeastward into India and Iran. Those are Indo-European. They were settled and conquered really by those people. They went they went east almost all the way to China. So a very, very successful group. They essentially they started on the steppes, and they had horses. They were the first group to really domesticate horses. So they were able to ride horses. That allowed them to have these very large herds of cattle and sheep. And they also became very adept at the military uses of horses, chariots and, you know, firing from chariots and so on. So this became a formidable force militarily. And these other groups were simply no match for them, and they marched everywhere, including into Europe. And those groups, you know, formed these dominant military elites pretty much down to the present. And one of the interesting things about Scandinavia in the Viking Age is that there were strong ties of kinship, but they were among the people at the top of the society. Mm-hmm. It was among these military elites. These were essentially family strategies. And so they were very aware of kinship, and kin did stand together. But if you look at most of the society, which were either slaves or or farmers of various types, who were pretty much all in these very dependent relationships with these military elites. In other words, Scandinavian society in the Viking era was very hierarchical. It was dominated by these military elites. These military elites were essentially family strategies that conquered certain areas, that were able to dominate certain areas. When they did dominate those areas, they basically forced tribute from farmers, and they had slaves and so on. Yep. So it was very much not an egalitarian society. This supplanted the previous hunter-gatherer ethic of that area. What I'm basically arguing is that hunter-gatherer ethic, since the 17th century, has made a comeback. Ah. And those old military elites have been basically thrown over. I've been doing most of my work on England and America. You had the American Civil War, was basically played out there, the English Civil War, and so on. This was the gradual decline of that Indo-European ethic of essentially military elites dominating the rest of the culture.
Yeah, I definitely want to go forward in the timeline, because you showed how, of course, people made it from the northern parts of Europe or Scandinavia over to England, and then of course from England to America, and we'll talk more about that. But I just wanted to mention something else here. I have a book here, The Horse, the Wheel, and Language by David W. Anthony. He's a professor of anthropology at Hartwick College, and he talks about this very thing as well, the Kurgans, or I guess the Aryan invasion, basically, that particular theory. And interestingly enough, it's a tidbit, maybe a side issue here, but there is even in the Norse sagas, the very aspect that the what's known as the Aesir actually invades into Scandinavia at some point and brings with them a very different way of life, whereas before this you had people called the Vanir. So you do have actually a reflection of that, interestingly enough, in some of the Norse sagas, that you have a kind of a shift in the power center, and a new tribe, if you will, comes in and changes the direction of Scandinavia. So that might very well be a correlation in the Norse sagas right there, Kevin.
That's very interesting. I wasn't aware of that. But, you know, it struck me just recently reading that those Kurgan graves that you see, very characteristic of the Indo-Europeans, you do see those in Sweden.
Yes.
These dominant military elites, you know, came in, and they reflected that Indo-European culture. And it's very competitive, but it's a very aristocratic culture. It is very hierarchical, and it is much more clan-based. That is, these families had close kinship ties with each other, although they were not completely closed off. I think people could rise in those societies. They were not, you know, if they found somebody who was a good soldier, you know, good at military kinds of things, they would recruit those people. And then they would get rewards. So it was not completely impermeable, but it was definitely hierarchical and based on military power, essentially. But that's what's been striking me, is that if you look at the military elites in Sweden, they reminded me very much of David Anthony's book about the Indo-Europeans, the same type of graves, the same types of, you know, military thrust of the society, where they, you know, they, for example, you know, David Anthony talks about these when young men were becoming adults, they had to go on raids. I mean, being part of a sort of military culture was absolutely essential to being an Indo-European. But when the Indo-Europeans spread, they did not wipe out the people before them. Instead, they subjugated them, and they demanded tribute, and they emphasized these pastoral economies where you had cattle and sheep and so on. So those economies were quite different, but it was essentially based on subjugating people who then were dependent on them, and they would protect those people, but in return for services, essentially a feudal system. I'm seeing more and more similarity throughout Europe to, that historically that goes back a long ways.
Yeah.
It's only in the last few centuries that has been overturned, really. We don't see that anymore.
Very interesting. Yeah, they definitely had thralls or slaves, and it was a very feudal system, as you said. And, of course, what's interesting is that they seem to have some, not vestiges, but some kind of early version of a democracy of sorts. They had something called a ting, for example, where you had, obviously, these were noblemen that probably gathered around some of the standing stone circles and whatnot to have, discuss certain, I guess, political and resource matters and things like this. But those were probably, though, of the more, what she would call them, aristocratic upper crust of the society. So it wasn't that everybody had a say within the society, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Those institutions were more, especially in the Middle Ages, were not about, commoners' rights. They oftentimes had very few, if any, rights. You have to remember, though, the Indo-Europeans were European. They had their sort of own form of individualism. Among their peers, the military peers. And in some ways, their societies were not as oppressive as a lot of the societies you see in other parts of the world. I think there was a sense of mutual sense, so that it wasn't pure exploitation of these farms. There was some sense of reciprocity. They would have big feasts and give gifts and so on. They were sort of chieftains. They're often called chieftains.
And yes.
They really are these military groups that I wouldn't call them completely oppressive, but they did have slaves. So this was a hierarchical society, very much so.
I think they had to be, too, for survival purposes. If we think about it, you had various other local tribes you might have been warring with, and they just realized that going together and to a certain extent have a king or a chieftain to make the directions, that would be a better direction to go for survival purposes. I don't think they had too much choice at the time, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't think anybody could really envision other ways of organizing society at that time. The Indo-Europeans had this military power, and I'm an evolutionist. I'm not surprised when people use military power to advance their interests and their ends, and that they formed these type of very hierarchical societies with kinship ties among other families in the same position as they are. But, speaking of kinship, kinship did not apply to the slaves, did not apply to the farmers that they were lording it over. Those people were not in extensive kinship groups. It was really the people at the top of the society that had those relationships. They were very important for them, but it didn't extend throughout society. And I've actually been reading more about these Germanic tribes, and from some stuff I was reading today, those tribes were not really ethnic groups. We tend to sort of think that they're ethnic groups, but in fact, they tended to form same way with those military elites and dependents who are not really related to them so much as they were dependent on them. And that, I think, is a big difference, because it's not really a cohesive ethnic group so much as it is a sort of conglomeration of people who are led by these elite families, but they're not closely related to the people that they are dominant over.
Interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting, because I've been reading quite a bit about the you have a movement of people, the migration age, obviously, but from late 400s up to 600 or something like that. You of course had movements of people both before and after this, so it's by no means. But a tremendous movement happens in that time in Europe specifically, and you do see things, for example, like the Goths migrating out of southern Scandinavia down to Poland for a while, and then eventually they split up and go two different directions, becomes the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths, the West Goths and the East Goths, and they seem to exactly just what you say. They seem to actually in somehow become involved in the population that was there locally, and they set up something new at the time, a new kind of structure. So that kind of speaks to what you just said, that I think the same is true with, for example, the Teutons and the Kimbri. They kind of merged together with some of the Gallic tribes, and they formed some kind of new society, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's right. All those groups, I think, had similar structure. I'm still doing a lot of research, but that's what the way it looks at to me now. That it's not those groups were not tightly kinship oriented, but more based on this model of a dominant military class, with their dependents.
Yeah, exactly. What happens is does it become more difficult? I mean, the migration age largely. To a large extent, I think you still have a lot of Germanic tribes. You also have some Celtic or Gallic tribes. They're, of course, closely related. As you said, they're all Europeans. But does that confuse things a lot, do you think, when you're looking for genetic traits and you're looking for clues within genetics when you already have had quite a bit of movement of people like that?
Yes, and I think there's been a lot of mixing. But what's interesting about the recent population genetics is that what they do see is they take skeletons from the period in Scandinavia where there were only hunter-gatherers, right?
Ah, okay.
And so they can figure out what those genes were like, and then they can compare that to more recent groups. And what they find is that present-day Scandinavians are more like those hunter-gatherers from way back before the Indo-Europeans than they are like to people in more southern parts of Europe. So that's what's so fascinating. They can actually look at this genetically. And of course, there has been quite a bit of mixing, but you know, those hunter-gatherer genes are much more common in northern Europe. And I think that's what sort of that cultural push since around the 17th century is for that extreme egalitarianism that we see. And I think also that some pathological altruism that's associated with it, because you would never see, you know, extreme egalitarianism or pathological altruism as part of Indo-European culture. That was just not part of the deal. Very different culture.
Can you tell us more about that? Tell us more about pathological altruism for those who don't know, and also how do you think the change occurred? You said 1700s for some reason. What happened there, do you think?
Well, I think the 1700s was the first movement to topple this model, this military elite model. And the first movement was the Puritan movement. You know, the Puritan, the English Civil War in the 17th century, I think, was the first inkling of the modern age. The Puritan movement was not a movement of the aristocracy. The Puritans were very egalitarian. And I think it is important that historically they did come from Scandinavia. And they produced societies that were not strongly hierarchical. There were some social class differences, but nowhere near the type of social class differences that you saw in the more... In these societies that were dominated by this Indo-European ethic, these societies were more egalitarian. These are very intelligent people, by the way. When they came to America, they produced the Harvard and Yale, all those Ivy League universities. As soon as they got there, they were very, very much very strongly education oriented. But very egalitarian, and this is the group that really opposed the Southern aristocracy in the Civil War, and so I'm sort of taking the Puritans and to some extent the Quakers, an extreme version of the Puritans, as a paradigmatic of what those people were like, and again, very different from the Indo-Europeans, from that military dominant ethic, a psychology of moral idealism, really. They would tend to set up societies based on some kind of blueprint that they thought, some sort of moral ideal, quite often. And in America in the 19th century, you had a lot of, especially in the Puritan part of America, which is essentially the East Coast, especially New England, but the Puritans were very successful. They had a very high fertility rate, and they spread across the United States and complete to the West Coast, ending up in Oregon and Washington. So really dominating the culture of the North, at least into the 20th century. And so the original came from East Anglia, and before that from Denmark. Relatively small social class differences, no slavery, a strong tendency towards creating these sort of utopian societies framed as moral issues. You see this commonly in 19th century America. And they're quite willing to incur great costs in order to achieve these moral ideals, what we call altruistic punishment. So in the Civil War, you had the loss of 700,000 men in those battles of the Civil War. That was seen as a cost worth bearing. Slavery was seen as an absolute evil by these people. And so they were willing to make these sacrifices of men and money to essentially carry this out. And if you look at the South during the Civil War, it essentially represented this very hierarchical, society that I think is fundamentally rooted in the Indo-European model. And so essentially the American Civil War was a battle between this more egalitarian ethic of the Puritans, of the sort of Northern European ethic, versus this Southern ethic based on a sort of planter, very strongly elitist, hierarchical society, close family relationships within that elite, but not between the elite and the people that they dominated. So that was the struggle. And of course, the anti-slavery forces won, as they did in England. And if you look right at England, the same sort of people were spearheading those movements. In this case, it was the Quakers, but certainly the remnants of the Puritans were on board with this. But the Quakers, extremely egalitarian group, also stemming from Denmark. And again, when you had these invasions from the Vikings in the 8th, 9th century, I believe, into England. But the people that ended up settling England from that were very egalitarian, even though it was typical that in those days, in the 9th century, they would have been brought over as part of the military force dominated by these elite, this sort of warrior aristocracy. So they themselves were not really as strongly inclined towards producing hierarchical society. And after that all disappeared, then these egalitarian tendencies came out, and the Quakers were extremely anti-slavery and for moral reasons. None of them ever benefited financially or in any other way from this movement.
Right, right. Well, see, this is very interesting, because obviously there's this movement of people, as you say. You had obviously Angles and Saxons migrating from southern Denmark and northern Germany to England in around, 400 or 500 maybe, and then you have a later wave, as you say, with the Vikings from 800 all the way up to 1020. I think it's Knut the Great, yeah, who actually take over England finally, a Dane, and mm-hmm. and then all the. But this is what's strange, I guess, with the two, though. I mean, you have, if those cultures are rooted in that kind of more should we say a Kurgan backdrop, then through their work, it seems like the egalitarian kind of comes through eventually. It's almost like it's an internal thing, that it's a change that occurs, or how do you think that breaks down on that level? Because these are, I guess, larger forces that kind of echoes throughout history. They come and go in these two factions almost, right?
Yeah, I think the main battlegrounds you have to think about in European history in the last several hundred years is the battle between that more egalitarian ethic and that more aristocratic ethic.
Yeah.
And that has been fought out. It's pretty clear who the ultimate winners have been. The aristocratic, I think, is gone. The aristocracy are gone. And that whole way of thinking is gone. But yeah, I think that that these Danes did come over. They invaded England. But if you look at the people they were bringing over as their soldiers and so on, these people were from the common folk, you know, of Denmark.
Right. I see. Yeah.
That's what I think is the general picture there. They were dependent on those military lords. They were soldiers for them. That was part of the you know, military service was one of the services that was required by people that were dominated by these military elites. And but essentially, those military elites were all about family strategizing. You know, when you look at watching a TV series on the Plantagenets, you know, the English royal family, you know, up until, I don't know, the 15th century, I guess, or even beyond that. And it was all about family struggles. I mean, it had nothing to do with freedom, democracy, or anything like that. It was basically families sometimes struggling with each other, sometimes struggling with other families. But that was essentially the pattern of European history. And it's like a broken record. but then something fundamentally changed in the 17th century with the rise of the Puritan Revolution. Cromwell, very different. And even though there was a restoration and all that afterwards, that had fundamental reverberations throughout in English history.
And a lot of blood, of course, as you said, have been shed in the name of bringing this to the people, right?
It has. Yeah. It has a lot of blood. And there's a lot of positive things about this revolution. But at the same time, we're seeing now, I think, some of the very negative things about this revolution.
Right, right. Can you tell us more about that, where you think this will lead? Because obviously, we're interested in talking about this because we want to try to understand what this means for us today, not only Scandinavians or those that are, you know, have are related to those, but this ability that we can't seem to fight back or turn the tide, that it's a moral issue that has to be switched within us, where we realize that it's not bad for us to look after who we are and our interests, but the current path we're on, that seems impossible to make that change happen.
It's very difficult. I agree. I think that the this revolution, which is essentially resulting in the suicide of the West, is a moral revolution. I mean, one of the points I made in the lectures and make a lot is that all the movements that I discuss in the Culture of Critique essentially were moral indictments, posing as science, but fundamentally they were moral indictments of the West. And what we have now is this moral, this zeitgeist, this sort of general feeling that the West is corrupt. When people think now of what is Western culture all about? Well, it's about slavery. You know, it's about anti-Semitism. It's about genocide of the Indians and so on. So in other words, that's what children are being taught now. And so what strikes me is that we've created this same kind of moral community that the Puritans created, that the Quakers created, and I think was common to these hunter-gatherer groups, that they create moral communities. That being admitted to this moral community is not based on kinship, but on agreeing with the moral premises of the group. But now this moral group essentially is indicting the entire past history of the West, and is indicting them on moral grounds, that there's something fundamentally morally defective about the West, and that's why we have to have all this diversity. There's something evil about the West, that we've always sort of had these horrible tendencies. And then they sort of forget about the fact that, sure, there was slavery, but there was also a movement within Western culture to end slavery. This was not something that there was a result of Jewish intellectual movements. Far from it. There's slavery is embedded in Jewish law. Jews have often been slave traders.
Yep.
This movement came from within the West, and it's fundamentally an egalitarian movement. It's a morally based movement, we have to understand our own interests as having a fundamental moral legitimacy, that we have an interest in preserving our people and our culture, just as other people do. And what that's what's being compromised now. It's almost like a moral imperative. I remember back when I was having all problems at my university, the department chair came in and asked me, are you opposed to immigration? And I said, I was opposed. And he made it sound, he had this feeling that this was just absolutely immoral.
Right,
know?
Right.
And so it's like this immigration and diversity and displacing white people, dispossessing white people, is a moral imperative. It's not something that needs to be justified economically. In fact, I've seen things, especially in the Swedish media or discussions, that if you even bring up the cost of immigration, there's something really wrong with you.
Absolutely. The environment, the climate of so-called debate is just beyond belief. I mean, it's
beyond belief. I mean, you can't talk about the costs in terms of the housing shortage. You can't talk about crime. You can't talk about welfare costs. You can't talk about the environment. No, all those things are subordinated to a moral imperative. And that's why, that's what I keep seeing over and over again, that when people criticized, when they were going after me at my university and so on, they didn't really try to refute my ideas. It was fundamentally a moral indictment. There's something wrong with me.
Yeah, right.
To even bring up the idea that Jewish intellectual movements were involved in promoting immigration policy for their own interests, that kind of thing. You can't bring that up.
In other words, it doesn't matter if you can prove it or if you can argue that point. It's just that's irrelevant, right?
It's irrelevant. And you can't, like, in America, we're importing a million people a year. Well, in 10 years, it'd be over 10 million people, because we're just really more than a million people a year. So that just imagine the infrastructure, the resources, the housing, and everything else that has to be built for these people. And, but you cannot. The Sierra Club, which is an important conservation group in America, when they were thinking about restricting immigration, immediately they started talking about the greening of hate. In other words, if you oppose immigration for ecological reasons, that's just greening hate.
Right.
In other words, you can't. That's not an argument. It can never be an argument against immigration. And that's, I'm sure that's the same debate that they have in Sweden.
Yeah.
You can't talk about. I mean, that film that you had, a fascinating film, I promoted on my website, showing that young Swedes have a hard time finding an apartment because they're giving all the housing to immigrants.
Well, but see, that's it though, right? Because then it's not about pushing egalitarianism. If it did, they would equally look after everybody, but they don't. Right. See, this is it. It seems higher on the hierarchy of the agenda to displacing the native populations, the white Europeans, and take care of others. In other words, sacrificing ourselves to provide this to others, right?
It's pathological altruism. I mean, it's pathological in the sense that what pathological altruism is it's hurting yourself to be altruistic to other people.
Yeah.
It's one thing to write a check to the local charity, but it's another thing to mortgage your house for another charity.
Right.
It's very different. And the other thing is absolutely self-destructive. So, that's what we see here. And so that we have to try to understand this, that no other people would do this. This is unique. I don't see any other people doing this.
No, it's true. Well, there's a couple of things here we should talk a little bit more about. Very, very interesting. Obviously, the very structure that we are talking about that these people have put in place, the question is if that could be maintained if we replace the population as is suggested now by the United Nations and others, for example, that if we take those very people that can uphold this egalitarian system or this altruistic system and change out those people, then obviously that structure is not going to be able to hold and stand anymore, correct?
That is quite correct. We have to almost assume, and we certainly can't assume the contrary, that when white people are displaced, that all of our institutions are going to go with it. When we think of America with a constitution, democracy, free speech, representative government, the Bill of Rights, all those things. Those things are going to be up for play. And even now in America, we have a strong sense of free speech, individual rights, and so on. One more vote on the Supreme Court, and there will be no more free speech when it relates to anything related to race or ethnicity. And that's the case quite often in Europe now. So yes. All these institutions are going to be swept aside. And if you look at the problems of the third world, does anybody seriously think you can bring all those people here and avoid the problems of the third world, the corruption, the oppression, the civil wars that we see in Africa, the intense ethnic infighting and so on? All these things are going to be transposed to Western societies, and they're not going to be Western anymore. We're going to be a minority in these cultures, and I do believe we will be a victimized minority. I mean, yes. There's a lot of, thinking about the American context, you think about, African Americans, you think about Jews, you think about even Mexico, and so on. They have historical grudges against white America. And some of that's justified. I mean, I'm not saying slavery is justified. It's just that would anybody want to put themselves in a vulnerable position? Because that is exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, but it has to be argued there that, every culture in the history of the world has practiced slavery in different ways. We might have been more efficient on it on certain levels, I guess, to a certain extent. But we get ample help from, many other peoples in different parts of the world to pull off the transatlantic slave trade, for example. But we were one of the first to end it, right?
And we were the first to end it.
Yeah.
When slavery was banned in England in 1807, and they finally, they was termed out about 1830, that was the first culture that ever banned slavery. And this was a time when slavery was common throughout the Arab world, throughout Africa. African slaves were taken from Africa, but there was a lot of endemic slavery within Africa. And, India, China, all these societies had slavery. Europe was the only society to do it, and they did it for moral reasons. That is absolutely unprecedented. And that is something that's completely forgotten in the contemporary narrative. All we hear now is Europeans own slaves. And the average person thinks that all Europeans did.
Right, yeah.
It was my ancestor didn't own slaves. Your ancestor didn't own slaves. But that Europe was the first and only country to end it for moral reasons. That people don't even know that.
That's right.
They are going to learn in school is how bad slavery was, and implying that all white people were doing this. It's propaganda.
Well, exactly. That's just it. And because it's used, we've spoken about this before, Kevin, but it is a weapon that is being used against us for those very reasons. And all of these accusations, these moral indictments, as you say, are used in such a way so that we will cease to put up any resistance to what is happening to us, correct?
And I think that people because Northern Europeans evolved in this way, they have a particular concern about shaming, about being someone who's a moral outcast. When this happens, I mean, the first time it happened to me, as in the faculty of the university, I wrote these things about these books about Judaism and so on. Finally, you had this movement against me. Well, it was so hard to suddenly realize you are a moral pariah. Someone that is looked down on. Someone won't talk to you anymore. And if they do talk to you, they insult you. They send you these really nasty emails. They want to leave. They want to get you fired and so on. That's what I experienced firsthand. It's very, very difficult. And I think most people don't know what it's like. But if you ever have it happen to you, it is something you'll never forget. It's a shame of being a moral outcast. And you can imagine, in a hunter-gatherer society in the Ice Ages, what it would be like. Say you did something that contravened the morals of the group. Say you did child abuse or you assaulted somebody or something like that, and they threw you out of the group. Well, you would have a sense of moral shame.
Well, isn't it more than that? Because now you're touching upon something which is very interesting. Is it not? Because the equal here is, the equation is that if you are thrown out, you won't be able to, it means death, right? That's right. Ultimately, right?
Evolutionary death.
Yeah.
And so strong selection for a sense of moral righteousness and a sense of being a moral person. So being condemned morally is like the worst of all possible worlds for a Northern European. It's absolutely the worst thing that, you know. In fact, guilt is uniquely Western European. You don't see guilt in other cultures. You see shame in other cultures. Shame means that somebody caught you doing something bad. And then, of course, you feel bad about it because everybody knows. Guilt, you feel bad about what you did, even though nobody knows about it. It's an intense personal sense that you have contravened the moral code that you believe in. You know, and that is just really psychologically very powerful.
So to a certain extent, we might argue that it's a fear of death, a fear of ultimately then going our own way that lies us at the root of this. And the question is, of course, is what needs to be done about that. To a certain extent, maybe be a little facetious here, but it's almost about we need to awaken that inner Kurgan, that chieftain that needs to rise within us so that we feel that because we can make the equation. This is what I'm getting to, Kevin. We can, if we look at what's happening right now and look at the projections and look at where this is going, using our brain to you know, connect the dots and look ahead, we can see a pattern rising in place. And that means if we don't change what's happening, we are not going to be able to be around to find out, basically. And that has to be enough to be able to use against the fear that we feel of being ostracized from the group, correct?
Right. Absolutely. I think you've sort of pointed to two ways that we can deal with it. One is to sort of reignite this sort of warrior mentality. I mean, we just don't see courageous men anymore. We see people who are truckling under that, who they don't, you know. You look at Beowulf, the poem, you know, and a big part of the Indo-European ethic was a sense of doing things for glory, for their own sake.
Yes.
You didn't really go out for you know, rewards of land and money, although that was part of it, but it was mainly about wanting to be thought of to you know, to go down in history with a sense of glory and which is, it's missing now. We don't see heroes. We see we see these truckling politicians lying through their teeth, you know, sucking up to the powers that be, the Israel lobby and so on in America. It's just a pathetic display when you look at our politicians now. But the other thing I think is maybe even more important is that we have to have a sense of our own moral legitimacy. And we have to, you know, make people realize that our interests are moral. We have to have our own moral community, invite people into it based on their moral attitudes. That, in other words, I think if Swedes could understand that having their own culture and their own people is a moral issue, and that it is legitimate for them to want that, that would change it. I don't think white people are going to act unless they see what they do as morally good.
You're right.
This extreme individualism of the Indo-Europeans, you know, it's hard to see that as morally good. It's very much about your own glory and conquering and all that. But we have to have people who are courageous, who are willing to give it up. But we have to also have a sense that what we're doing is morally defensible.
Very well said, Kevin. Wonderful way of putting that. And so obviously this is something that can be awakened in us here to have us understand also that if we go out the window, even the very system of this egalitarian way that we like to run things will go out the window. And so, you know, we have to be use our rationality there. But I guess to a certain extent, it is primarily at this stage on an emotional level. And that's where the battle needs to be waged at this point. It's not that we don't have the numbers. It's not that we don't have the reasoning and the logic behind us or you know, all of this. It's an emotional thing, isn't it?
Yes, it's an emotional thing. And I think right now all their emotions are they're opposed to our interests. You know, I think there's this strong conformist tendency, which is part of egalitarianism, and that people are convinced now that the traditional Swedish society, traditional white societies around the world, they are essentially immoral. They're in need of essentially fundamental eradication. As long as significant numbers of people believe that, I think that we're in trouble. But that's why it's so important to control the high points of society. That's why we are in the position we're in. This has been a top-down revolution. It's been produced by, you know, very top-level, you know, intellectual movements at our leading universities. When I talk about the culture critique, I emphasize that these movements made their headway at Harvard and other very prominent universities, very elite publishing companies, very, very top level, you know, these various media companies, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times, Hollywood. These were top down messages. And so part of my presentation is to emphasize that these messages have been coming in our rational part of our brain, the cortical part, and they have suppressed a lot of our natural tendencies, which are very healthy. But they've created this moral community where these very legitimate interests that we have in preserving our people and culture have been vilified as the height of immorality. We have to turn that around, but it's very difficult when we do not control the high points of our society. I mean, I can't point to one media outlet in America or Europe, really, that is a mass marketing kind of thing that has our message in it.
Exactly. It's just remarkable, isn't it?
We are relegated to the extreme fringes, and that's no accident. I mean, they police the media very strongly. If someone were to come out, even someone who's very popular, like, say Bill O'Reilly in America, and I don't know what the analogy would be in Sweden, but
we don't have any. Go ahead.
He's fairly conservative. Say he came out and he really started saying, you know, white people have a right to try to preserve their people and their culture, just like everybody else. America should be able to regulate their immigration policy. The white Americans have an interest in this policy, and we should be able to pursue it. And so, there would be huge pressure on him. You suddenly see pressure on advertisers.
Yep.
The network would have pressure. He would either be fired or he'd be relegated to a much lower level in his media hierarchy. He would lose millions of dollars. He's not going to do that. You know, and so much of the people who talk about pathological altruism, a lot of these people who are pathologically altruistic are really nice people. They are very moral. But then you also have people like Bill Clinton and so many of our politicians who are sociopathic. They don't care about anything but their own little careers.
Yep.
And do anything or say anything to get ahead. And so, and I think Bill Clinton's a good paradigm of that kind of mentality. These people are just venal. They are absolutely corrupt.
Absolutely. I mean, and
altruistic. They're anything but.
And they sweet talk everybody. They say whatever they have to say to get ahead. And since that at the current time is this politically correct tyrannical dictatorship that we're under, they follow suit. They have no other drives whatsoever. But Kevin, let's take a short break here in just a little bit. We have much more to ask you about. But before we break, just tell us about the Occidental Observer, the book titles you have, and the publication as well that comes out. Every other month, right?
Well, we have the print copy also available online of the Occidental Quarterly. This is a quarterly journal, academically oriented articles, fairly long articles typically, and that is a very important journal. I strongly suggest people subscribe to it. We also have the Occidental Observer, which I edit, with shorter articles, I often write like op-ed type articles on there, 2,000 or 3,000 words, and the website for the Occidental Observer is the occidentalobserver.net. I also have a personal website where you can see where my where my books are available via various websites and so on. And I've written several books on Judaism as an evolutionary strategy. I've also written the book called Cultural Insurrections. The main book regarding Judaism is The Culture of Critique. This is these Jewish intellectual movements. I only say it's the main book because this is the one that's most relevant to the 20th century, 21st century. This is the time period when Jews became a dominant elite in the West. And so much of the fact that these messages that pathologize white people, pathologize Europe, pathologize our past, pathologize our people. These are coming from the very elite media, academic world, in which Jews have a very prominent part at this time.
Very good. Now, the website's kevinmcdonald.net and also the occidentalobserver.net. And make sure you subscribe to the Occidental Quarterly as well. It's a great publication, some fascinating and just excellent articles in there that you need to read and get up to speed with. And then, of course, check out Culture of Critique as well. We'll make sure to have a link to the book by Kevin McDonald right on our website. All right, folks, stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Kevin. We'll take a short break and then we'll be right back. From the waves. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you should stay with us in the second hour as we proceed at redicemembers.com. A very important hour number two is coming up, and we're going to continue to hear what Kevin MacDonald have to say about the control of the media that refuse to hear or discuss any of these concerns. We discuss a bit about what has been happening in Baltimore and why most of the media side against the police every time now, no matter what the facts suggests and what kind of conditions that this might create in the long run. We discuss what the saturation point of immigration might be and how global poverty is not something that is going to be solved by bringing in millions of poor people into Western countries. I bring up an example of a White Appreciation Day that happened recently as a way to demonstrate that you are not allowed to show any kind of positive feelings towards European Americans, as this is considered to be hateful. So it's not until you show utter hate and contempt for European Americans that you are a good, moral, upstanding person. We talk about the Mediterranean immigration crisis and also how the Nazi stereotype that we find in movies and TV shows is something that the media love to give focus on. There are many white supremacists and also white supremacy groups that have been infiltrated, run, and in some cases even created by the FBI and FBI agents, possibly as a way to preemptively associate a negative image towards those who express concern for the future of European civilization. And hence, in that way, you can bundle these together in one and say that one is the other, as the charge of Nazi constantly is something that is used against us as a way to prevent opposition to, for example, the demographic transformation that is now taking place and the displacement of Europeans in their own countries, something that, by the way, is only taking place in European countries. We also speak a bit about AIPAC, the Israel lobby, and why, despite the fact that most European Americans now vote for the Republican Party, that could be much, much, much worse considering the detrimental foreign policy of the grand old party. Sign up and tune in at redicemembers.com for this second hour and all of our programs in full. We have a lot of material for you to dig into, close to 1,000 radio programs, also videos, TV episodes, and the full Radio 314 archives as well. Well, we have much more coming up, folks. You have the full upcoming guest list in our radio archives, but we'll proceed right after this break. Stay with us. Thank you for listening.